time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
And welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for July 21st, 2018. Tonight, it's three very diverse topics with three great guests. My first guest is Dorothy Pacheco. When we talk about women in the bike industry, we don't always see someone who is so broadly versed in a variety of business disciplines. Dorothy, who was born and raised in Colorado, was one of the first people to bring mountain bike racing to the U.S. in the form of NORBA, the National Off-Road Bicycling Association, where she set up the first series of races. Then she helped to bring mountain bike racing to the Olympics, where it was a medal sport at the Atlanta Games. Today, Dorothy is on the board of Little Bellas, which we'll discuss, and is the sales and marketing manager for a new line of bicycles that will be introduced at Interbike this September, Batch Bikes. Then after a short break, we're going to talk with bicycle artist Talia Lempert. If you've ever seen her work, you know that it is instantly recognizable. Her paintings of bicycles, both old and new, are bold and colorful, and her commissions come from all over the world. Today, we're going to talk a bit about her new book project. It's her third, titled Classic Bicycle Coloring Book. Taken from paintings she's done in the past, the drawings are a unique way to express your own creativity. Lastly, and I know this subject is always contentious and seems to come up way too often, I'm going to speak with Georgia Bike Law's Bruce Hagen. This week, he posted an article on his blog titled, Another Cyclist Killed, Another Shoddy Police Investigation. While this is the crux of the conversation, something that Bruce said has stuck with me. He said, if your brain is shut off at the existence of cyclists, of course it appears like we come out of nowhere. It's a telling comment and one that we discuss in some detail. So here we go. It's off to Dayton, Ohio, to speak with Dorothy Pacheco. Hi, Dorothy. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, you're kind of a Colorado transplant here in Ohio, and there seems to be a lot of history behind the work you're doing. Can we rewind and look at that before we talk about your new project, which I do want to talk about? Tell us where you grew up and how you got into athletics and especially cycling.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I grew up in Colorado. I'm an eighth generation native, and my family and I had the good opportunity to be able to go skiing every weekend. And I'm one of four kids. They packed the car up and we drove up to Vail every single weekend before Vail, as pretentious as it is now. But had a great time skiing there, and we needed something to do in the summer, so we just rode bikes all summer long up in the mountains. So it was a really cool opportunity to be a kid in Colorado growing up.
Which means you can handle the altitude.
Yeah, I can, definitely.
Yeah, that's a problem I've always had, you know, coming from pretty much sea level, going into Utah or Colorado. It takes me a couple of days. So you were involved with the original mountain bike association, NORBA. Now, a lot of people today may not know what NORBA is. It was the National Off-Road Bicycle Association. I remember when it came about. Tell us a little bit about the beginning of NORBA and what you did with them.
Yeah, so NORBA was started by Glenn O'Dell, and USA Cycling had the good, they were called the Feds then, they had the good fortune to purchase NORBA back in the day. And I was studying for the bar exam after graduate school and as a volunteer for this thing called the Junior World Cycling Championship. And my soon-to-be boss said, hey, we're starting this thing called NORBA. Do you want to run it for us? Because nobody really knows what to do. And I said, okay, that sounds great. And, you know, working under the Olympic umbrella with the Olympic movement on the Olympic Training Center is pretty special. And so I knew what I had to do from day one, and we started an 8-series race format across the country because, hey, mountain biking was pretty new, and people were doing it, but not as organized. So started across the country and had a lot of really great response from Shimano, as well as several other bike manufacturers. GT was one of the forays, as well as Gary Fisher, as we all know that story. But they were instrumental in starting mountain bike racing and making sure that others followed the same way. It was very much of a festival event whenever you went to an event across the country, and people really wanted in on the fun. And it was a growing sport, and I know we weren't able to sell a lot of mountain bikes as a result of it for the industry, and got mountain biking going and racing going. Then UCI, the International Cycling Commission, kind of wanted to get involved as well. And the word spread over in Europe that we were racing. A lot of Europeans were coming over and trying their hand at mountain biking here in the U.S. And so UCI got involved, and we started the World Cup Series around the world, and basically in North America as well as Europe. So we started racing in Europe, which was pretty amazing because a lot of the kids that raced over there had never been out of the country, and racing in Europe is a whole nother game. But it was fun to get the cultures together and everybody involved in mountain bike racing in the world.
I can remember when mountain bikes first came on the scene. You know, I go back way before mountain bikes, and remember access was such a hassle that there were so many places that would not allow mountain biking, and that has changed so much. When did mountain biking become, and I think it is an Olympic sport. It is an Olympic sport, isn't it?
Yeah, it became an Olympic sport in 1996. That's where it made its debut, at Conyers, Georgia. It was a really cool event because that was one of the first Olympics that new discipline was a full medal sport, not just a non-medal sport, if you will. So it wasn't on trial. So it was a full medal sport, and actually that day you had to bring in a winter sport as well as a summer sport. And so the winter sport that came in was snowboarding, and mountain biking came in the summer. So that was one of the first summer sports that was added as a full medal sport in Conyers, Georgia. So, you know, unfortunately, Americans didn't win, but we got a close second, if you will. But we were fortunate to have the first Olympic Games here on the U.S. soil.
Yeah, we won that way. You know, we got to have them here. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dorothy Pacheco. I hope I said your last name correctly.
You did.
Oh, good. You know, I want to talk about one more thing before we actually get to the meat of what we're talking about today, and that is Little Bellas. Now, I have contacted Sabra Davison, and she is going to be on the show later on this month. But I'd like to know basically what Little Bellas is from you and how you're involved in it, what you decided to do about this.
Yeah, you know, Sabra is an amazing human being. Her sister, Leah, is still a professional cross-country rider and mountain bike rider. And I cannot say enough about those gals. They have dedicated their life to mountain biking, and not only selfishly taking mountain biking just for them, but they started an organization called Little Bellas, and it's getting little ladies on bicycles, and it's teaching them how to ride a bike and have fun on a bike. So not only are these gals coming out and riding a bike, but they want to stay on a bike, and they want to actually buy bikes and buy their second and third bikes. And so starting another section of Little Bellas for the older gals, because you know, once you graduate a certain level, you have to move on. And okay, understandably so, because other gals have to become involved in Little Bellas. But I think there's just so much of an opportunity to help teach these young gals to ride bikes. It's not really about racing. It's just about getting out, learning how to ride a mountain bike, getting the skills, and honestly, just having a lot of fun. And this year was really kind of cool because they sold out in the spring for all of their events that they have offered, which is really amazing. And when Sabra and Leah approached me a couple of years back and said, hey, would you want to be on our board? And I asked him what it was entailed. And it's a working board. So you actually have to do a lot of work for them. And I am super lucky to be leading marketing for them. And boy, I mean, I don't lead it. Sabra is the one that leads it and her team. So she does a lot of great stuff for the organization. I just help with the RFPs and put some marketing pieces together with social media as well. So they've got a lot of great things going, and it's just an honor to be on the board for Little Bellas.
Sabra Davison is going to be on the show. I think it is the week of the 23rd, and we will get real in-depth about Little Bellas then. So can we take a real short break, and we'll come right back, and we're going to talk about what you're doing now?
Sounds great.
Okay. We're speaking with Dorothy Pacheco. She is actually going to talk to us about something called Batch Bikes. It's brand new. We'll be right back after a short break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back. And if you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Dorothy Pacheco. She is sales and marketing manager, I would imagine, for this new product that's coming out of Dayton, Ohio, our home state here, out of the Huffy Corporation. And I actually would like to know something about Huffy, because, you know, when people think about Huffy, they think big box and they think cheap, which is not altogether a good combination. But that seems to be changing. Tell us a little bit about what Huffy's up to today and your position with them, what you have developed.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I have to say, there's one gentleman here. He's our CEO, Bill Smith, is just an amazing, dynamic person. He happened to be at the IBD Summit now 3 years ago in Arizona. And he actually spoke about some of the diversities that Huffy is getting into. And one of those diversities is creating service centers for the IBDs, as well as, he said it, you know, he wanted to create an IBD initiative for the industry because he saw the need for an IBD initiative. And yes, you're right. Huffy is big box. It's mass. They make great bikes for an entry-level rider. And that's probably not most of the people that are listening today, but it's also, it's a way for people, a gateway to, for people to get into cycling. And what Bill has tasked me with and Chris Keller with is, and our team, is basically coming up with a really great bicycle line for the recreational rider. And that's quite different than the enthusiast, because what we're trying to accomplish is selling bicycles to the independent bike dealers, not to the consumer, but to the dealers, and actually getting a new person to come into their shop and befriend them and have them have a relationship and create a relationship with these people. So it's a big task, but it's also, it's really kind of fun because I tell you, I mean, moving from Boulder, Colorado to Dayton, Ohio wasn't easy, but at the same time, when they asked me to come and help lead this initiative, I said, for sure, because not many people get this great opportunity. And we'll have five different bicycles. We're launching Interbike this year, and they will not be sold to the consumer at all directly. We'll be selling only to the IBD, and we'll be developing relationships with those IBDs.
When we think about the IBD today, there's a lot of turmoil based on the online. So I can remember years ago, people would come into my store with the Bike Nash Bar catalog, and that was our competition. And then it was Performance Bike, and that was our competition. Then it was Walmart. Mm-hmm. And so every dealer who looks at those and says that's our competition is probably, in my, this is my opinion, they're missing the mark. Those are not their competition. You can't compete with those people. You need to do something different. So I am assuming that Batch Bikes is offering something different. And that's what you're looking for, to get a dealer to look at his or her business from a different perspective.
Yeah. And it looks, you know, Batch Bicycles, I'll tell you, is we'll have a program. It's not a program. So we'll just throw that out the window.
Yeah.
Right
okay. I think that's good.
Approach. And that's, you know, a lot of IBDs don't understand that. And I'll say you can buy one bike from us or you can buy a container of bikes from us. And that's not what we're after. We want the relationship with the independent bicycle dealer, and we want to make sure they have the tools that they need to bring that recreational rider into the store. And, you know, you have somebody who goes to a big box store and they're like, okay, I'll buy a bike and I don't know what I'm buying. And they take it off the shelf and they ride it a couple times maybe, or they don't ride it at all, or whatever. You know, they need to graduate to the next level, and or they need it fixed. So Huffy's provided the opportunity to create service centers. And these service centers are, we'll help the independent bike dealer get that bike back out on the road for that consumer, or have that consumer come into the bike shop and maybe they buy a brand new bike. That's kind of a cool thing, you know, and so the IBD is making money there. So when you think of Batch Bicycles, we'll have our own app, and the IBDs will order on our own, on our app or on our website on their own portal. And like I said, we won't have a program for them. We'll have high margins for them, but we'll also have the opportunity for them to buy our bikes under the guise of their business model. We're not forcing them to create a business model. We're not forcing them to create a plan. So it's whatever works in their locale.
So what are the bikes themselves? So you have models and how did you come up with the name Batch?
Yeah, okay. You have two good questions. So Batch Bicycles is, it's kind of a cool name. I mean, we can create something that itty-bitty batch, small batch, large batch, batch 1, 2, 3. Batches is a name that it resonates in so many sectors. When we did our market studies, that so many people are like, I like that name, Batch. It's warm, it's fuzzy, it creates a community sense of appeal of, hey, I want to be part of this movement, and I really want to be part of this brand. And so we'll have five different bikes, styles of bikes. We have a path or comfort bike, if you will, a cruiser bike, mountain bike, a commuter bike, and then, of course, a full array of kids' bikes.
And you have something that you can't talk about today. Okay, I will let you off the hook on that one, although I am interested. So I guess one of the questions I have, and of course, this is the big elephant in the room all the time with bike dealers, is the whole quote unquote women's market. Now, I'm a person who believes it's a people's market. People ride bikes, not just women, not just men, just people. What's wrong with people?
Sure.
I don't know how you're addressing that in terms of, you know, they used to say pink it and shrink it, which is just used to piss me off. What are you looking at in terms of maybe graphics or the kinds of things that will just attract people to this brand?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So all of our bikes will come in, not all of them, but most of our bikes will come in just three colors. We're really, really simple. The cruiser, for example, the woman's cruiser, is a step through. You know, that's kind of a nice bike. You can step through. You go to your yoga class. You ride down to the beach. You go across to get your groceries, whatever. It's just a nice, simple bike to ride. All of our bikes will be aluminum with Shimano components. And our commuter bike is really kind of cool because it has a nice rack on the back, which you can actually ride your bike to work. I mean, I see a lot of millennials now that they have a lot of stuff on their plate. They have a lot of big budget items. They've got student loans. They've got Hulu. They've got Spotify. They've got all this other stuff. Maybe they're living with their parents. Maybe they don't want a car. So what are they doing? They're riding to work. So this commuter bike, you know, it's not going to set them back a lot of money. All of our bikes will be sub $500, and they can ride their bike to work, and they can have fun, and they're not going to be in debt buying our bikes.
Well, the question I had for you just got answered because I remembered it finally with my brain, and that was, do you think that bicycles in general, when you walk into a bike shop, are too expensive? There was a barrier to entry because of expensive bikes, but if everything's going to be under $500, I can see that we can bring in a whole nother group of people who maybe wouldn't be cycling.
Sure. So you have somebody that's coming into your bike shop and maybe one person in the family buys a, I don't know, $5,000, $10,000 bike. That's great. We want them to do that. But what about the rest of the family? I mean, little Susie is sitting there crying her eyes out and she'd love to have that bike. But oh, by the way, somebody else's bike could be really expensive. I mean, our balance bikes are very affordable. We're going to have that opportunity to have bikes at a great price point for the whole family. This person who doesn't know anything about cycling, that doesn't really know names in the industry, all they want to do is ride their bike with their family. They'll have the opportunity to do that, and they're not going to be set back a mortgage payment or, you know, in debt for buying a bike for the whole family.
How big is the Batch Bike brand compared to the Huffy family of bikes?
Good question. So, again, Bill Smith has the wonderful foresight to create several other initiatives under the Huffy umbrella. And I know Batch Bicycles really well. I know of the other initiatives that are happening here at Huffy, but I don't really want to go down that road because it's a big can of worms. And it's a really cool, amazing time to be at Huffy because, sure, everyone has to understand their relevancy in the world, right? And I think that Bill Smith knows, the board knows, and upper management knows that, wow, we have to really stay relevant in this world. And they're not asleep at the wheel. It's really a fun time to be at Huffy because I go to one part of the building, and that's where they're building all of the Disney and Marvel and bikes that are, it's fun. It's like Candyland over there, you know. And then our area is the initiative area, which is all of the new business units. And it's just like a little startup incubator here in Dayton, Ohio, which is like, wow, in Dayton, Ohio, it's really happening here. So there's a lot of buzz happening here. And, you know, even some of the people that have been at the company for, I don't know, 20, 30 plus years, they're super excited about being here. Not only did we move into a new building, but we're starting all these new initiatives. And it's really fun to come to work in the morning and share the enthusiasm. And you know what? One thing Bill does every month is he has an employee meeting, and everybody stops what they're doing. We all talk about our business unit. We all talk about what's happening in the company du jour. And it's just a half an hour. And, you know, he does a great job. He leads it well. And then we all go back to work. So nobody's left in the dark of siloing, of, you know, posturing of what's doing what and who's doing what. So it is a really amazing opportunity to be here. And, you know, there's over 100 people here. And, again, we live in Dayton. People are really nice here. But it's a really comfortable environment to work in.
So this is a question that didn't occur to me until you started talking about the other initiatives. I don't know how much manufacturing is being done in stateside. Are you experiencing tariff issues yet, or will you, do you think?
You know, I'm sure everybody's going to be affected by it. I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't have any answers at all. I'm just reading what I think everybody else is reading in the news, so I'm not very close to it, so I'm probably not the person to ask about
this.
But yeah, you know, we're talking about it amongst ourselves, amongst upper management, and I think it will affect us all, unfortunately, but I really don't really want to talk too much more about it just because I would not be talking factually.
That's fine. I just didn't know if you knew, because I know that your background is marketing and sales, but you're also an attorney.
I did go to law school. You're correct. I've never taken a bar exam, but I did go to law school.
Yeah, but you know, it's year one that they cram all that stuff into you. So, I know, it's crazy the first year of law school. My son-in-law is an attorney, and I can remember the first year. It was like, oh, my goodness. So I'm going to ask you a few personal questions, if you don't mind. Are you still riding?
Oh, my God, I ride to work every day.
Oh, good.
I think it's important to ride because, you know, you have to talk the talk and walk the walk. And I just love riding. You know what I mean? I ride on the weekends, and I try to ride as much as possible. So my commute's only 10 miles one way. But, you know, Dayton has an amazing array of bike trails here.
Yes, you do.
You'd be surprised at how nice the motorists are when you're riding your bike on the road. So I have to cross some busy roads. And, you know, even though everybody's going to work at the same time, they're super nice. So, of course, I definitely still love to ride.
Do you like living in Southern Ohio? It's so different from Colorado. I mean, it's like, you know, black and white, whatever. But do you like it?
Sure. You know, I have to say, I never in my wildest dreams thought I would ever be living in Ohio. And so it's an opportunity because, wow, I mean, where we're living now in our home, that where we're at is super cute. We walk to the grocery store every day, and we just have the opportunity to meet so many different people that it's very different than Boulder. And in my little bubble in Boulder, I grew up knowing everybody in my neighborhood, everybody in my elementary school, and I wasn't branching out enough. So I think it's a really cool opportunity to meet other people and also learn about where you live. I mean, talking about the Cleveland Park Emerald Necklace Network of Writing. Wow. I mean, I really want to go do that now.
You should come up. But you know what? We love the Little Miami Trail system, and it goes right through Dayton and Dean and Springfield. We love it down there.
Yeah, that's how you ride that almost every day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right, so I have three questions I always ask my guests. What's your favorite food?
Well, that's easy because I'm a Mexican. I love Mexican food. So I love
that was easy.
Mexican food. There are two taco trucks, Mexican taco trucks here in Dayton. Of course, I've already become friends with them. So it's fun to go visit them and enjoy that food.
And what music do you like to listen to?
Yeah, you know, I'm super into vinyl. And
oh, good for you.
Yeah, it's just really cool. And whatever I can get my hands on, and it's just, it's fun to listen to music on vinyl. It's also really cool to see the artists come up with new ways of performing and putting out their vinyl. So it's neat to see that they're getting involved in it as well.
My last question is always about animals. Do you have any pets?
I so wish. We're just about ready to get a dog in Boulder, and then we moved here, and we just have to get a little more settled, and then I think we might have a pet in our future. So
yeah, of course, of course.
Yeah.
Well, it's been delightful to speak with you to learn about the new Batch bicycles. They will be introduced at Interbike. We're speaking with Dorothy Pacheco. She is with the Huffy Corporation division of bicycles called Batch, B-A-T-C-H. You'll be able to find them, this fall, yes?
Exactly. We start sale the 1st of September.
There you go. We're not that far away.
And thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate that.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much. We'll talk again.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Dorothy Pacheco joined me from her office at the Batch Bicycle Division of Huffy Corporation. It sounds to me like Huffy is looking at our industry in a very broad and modern way. It will be interesting to watch. So let's take a short break, and then I'll be back to talk with artist Talia Lempert. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We've talked with a host of frame builders over the years, and many have either attended art school or started out with an artistic vision of bicycles. Artists need to make art. And my next guest, Talia Lempert, is a hardworking, prolific, and very distinctive artist whose subject just happens to be bicycles. People want to own a Lempert, and she is busy with a wide variety of projects. Today, we're going to talk about a couple of them. Hi, Talia. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's great to talk with you again.
Thank you. It's great to talk with you. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, well, the last time we spoke, we were chatting about holiday gifts prior, believe it or not, to the 2016 gift-giving season. Seems like it's been way too long for us to catch up. I haven't even seen you at a show.
Ah.
You've been there, but I may not.
Yeah, I've been at Philly. I think since the last time I saw you, I was there last year. It's been a great show.
Yeah, and we are going back this year. So how have you been? You seem very, very busy.
I've been good. I've been busy and good, and you know, writing and painting and making stuff.
Making stuff. Well, I saw a new we follow each other on Facebook, and I saw a new bicycle painting that was at the time was leaving the U.S. for its new home in Germany. You're getting commissions from out of the country. That's kind of interesting.
Well, I've actually always sold kind of all over the place. And I mean, that's one of the cool things about the web. And that was an existing painting that was, it's maybe like 3 years old, and it was a painting of a Pop Brennan, a vintage track bike that was built in New Jersey in the early 20s.
It was really cool looking bike.
It was beautiful and just so kind of elegant and a really fine racing bike. It was just a cool thing to have in my studio.
I'm sure. So how did so the person who owns it actually lives in Germany. So did he or she ship the bike over? No?
No, actually, well, that one wasn't a commission. That was people buying existing paintings, which is actually, you know, happens a lot, which is really lucky because it works out well.
Yeah, it does work out well.
That was from a guy that lived in actually New York State, and he loaned me three different bikes that were all hand-built local bikes, that one from New Jersey and then two from New York, one from Manhattan and one from Queens. And I ended up doing a bunch of paintings of all three bikes and then trading him. He's a collector. His name's Eddie Albert. And he traded me one of the bikes for a painting, which was pretty awesome.
Wow, that's a really good way to get a bike.
It was really, it was really, really great. And but the bike that I'm working on now is a commission that's for a guy in Sweden. And he's been following my work or I've known him for years now. And he ended up getting a picture of the frame of his PVP bike. And I'm almost done with it. I've been working on it for a while. And then he's actually going to be back in the United States in August, and he'll pick it up then.
So is he going to ride that bike in PVP next year?
No. He rode it. And I think that it's a carbon frame, and I don't know that it will. I think it's done. And he rode it a few years ago, maybe like, I want to say 2016.
Well, the PBP's last PBP would have been 2015 if you wrote it
that
in.
That must have been it.
Yeah, okay. Because it's every 4 years. Yeah, it's coming up next year. So what was really cool about the bike, about the painting that went to Germany, was the color of that bike. It was so different from what we see today.
You know, it was such a beautiful bike. And it was, Eddie told me that he bought it from a guy. I guess it was found in a basement when a house was being cleared out, or you know, maybe an estate sale or something. And the guy that owned it was rumored to have been in the Olympics in the 20s, in like 28, I think. Do I have the year right?
Well, who knows? I mean, that's so cool,
32.
Though. That is really cool.
Which is pretty cool. So I don't know if he used that bike, but it was so light and just, you know, the rear stays were like pencil thick and it was so beautifully built and just it's amazing when you see older bikes that are really fine racing bikes and just the mojo is pretty strong.
Right. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Talia Lempert. If you want to see a picture of this bike, this beautiful track bike, you can go to her Facebook page, I think, and take a look. Anyway, the reason I wanted to catch up with you today is your classic bicycle coloring book. It was published in April. And while it isn't your first coloring book, I want you to just explain how making these line drawings and then offering them up for others to finish, how do you do that? Are you using bicycles from real life or are you like from memory? It's such a cool idea.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, this is my third coloring book and I'm so proud of it. The drawings are actually, I make them from my paintings. So the paintings I make while looking at the actual bicycle and having it in my studio and really spending some time with it. And then I'll take those paintings and I trace them and make drawings from them. And yeah, and so they all come from real bikes.
So
a few steps removed.
Because I don't want to tell people exactly what it is. I really I do have my own copy of the classic bicycle coloring book. The one before this is a little bit different. The two before this, when you say classic bicycle, you are talking classic steel bikes, I think.
Yeah, well, for the most part, yeah, and I believe they are steel in here. There might actually be an aluminum.
As she flips through her book, to see if
it
isn't. So, do you give people suggestions about how to finish these bikes, or are they just like, go for it, go get your colored pencils or your crayons or your markers and finish it the way you want? Are you showing what that bike looked like originally anywhere?
I like it when people are creative. I like seeing what people do. I started making coloring books because I like the collaborative aspect, you know, and I like that it feels like we're doing a project together. And I like seeing what people do with it. And there's a lot that you can do, you know. And I think I'm all for coloring outside of the lines. And people sometimes send me pictures, and it's delightful.
Well, that was going to be my next question. So people color them, and then they send you a picture of what they did. That's kind of cool. It's like, you know, making a picture and giving it to the teacher and having him hang it on the wall, the bulletin board in the classroom, right? Do mostly adults buy this book or use this book, or are kids getting into it, which would be really cool, too?
I think it's a mix. From the past ones I've done as well, it's been a mix. And that's been great.
So besides crayons, which, of course, everybody wants their box of Crayolas, and color pencils, which I always liked color pencils, are there other media that people use? Is anybody using, like, Conti crayons or charcoal or anything like that?
Well, I like watercolor. And
ooh!
I think people are using a lot of watercolor. I like watercolor for coloring things in, because you can be really detailed with it and also really messy and free with it.
Yeah, I didn't even think of watercolor. You can get those real thin kind of wispy things, and then you can get real thick with it. I'm terrible with oil. Terrible. I turn oil into mud, basically. So I know that you can get the book on Amazon, because I saw it there. But it was Microcosm that published that book. Has she published the other two also?
The other two are self-published.
Ah.
So, and actually, Microcosm would buy and sell it from me, the last one. But this one they published, which is great.
Yeah, she's great. Ellie Blue, she's really good. So, you know, besides your coloring book and besides your commissioned paintings, you seem to have a little bicycle art empire. You know, you have your custom commission pieces. I seem to remember you had coffee cups and T-shirts and, of course, the coloring book and magnets. Are you working on anything new for the upcoming season?
You know, I'll have a calendar.
Ooh, nice.
Which is pretty great. I actually I've been making calendars with an Italian company called Bagname for a few years, and it's really great. They did such a beautiful job, and they should be arriving pretty soon, actually, the 2019 one. And just this morning, I sent them images for 2020, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, that is. You're working ahead. No more crazy deadlines, right?
I know. Time is already going so fast. And actually, in the 2020 calendar has a picture of both the Pop Brennan bike that we talked about earlier, the painting I just sent to Germany,
right,
and the thing that I'm working on now.
Which is?
So pretty great.
What are you working on right now?
Oh, the Swedish bike.
Oh, the Swedish bike. Right, right. The one that's going to Sweden. So are you going to be at Philly?
Yes.
Will you have calendars?
I will.
Oh, that'll be cool.
The calendars are so nice, and they always go really fast. And
yeah, I'm sure.
It's a fun thing, as well as like a bunch of new prints and shirts and drawings.
What I really like when I come to your booth at these shows is it just this splash of colorful artistic things. And having been to art school and not practicing that, I understand somebody who is driven to do art, you know. And it's such a pleasure when somebody is talented and you get to see all this stuff kind of oozing out of them. So you also do a lot of street fairs. I think that's really interesting. I don't know where you find all this time, but every time I look at your Facebook page, like, well, come see me at, and you fill in the blank. So What do you bring to the street fair? So do you have this little like portable table and booth and stuff that you take?
Yeah, well, I ride everything on my cargo bike.
Of course you do.
Fair, so. So you'll see pictures of my cargo bike on there too.
I did. It's blue.
Yeah, it's a big blue cargo bike.
Right.
It's pretty awesome. And I have, you know, like a tent, a 10x10 pop-up tent, and I bring a lot of prints. I have a few print racks and a lot of prints and drawings and T-shirts and mugs and coloring books and calendars and all kinds of stuff. It's pretty great. I meet a lot of people, and it's really fun to see people looking at my work without, you know, any ideas about it, just to come upon it. And it's really great. I've met a lot of people doing that. And actually the mugs, there's some opportunities that have sprung up from that. It's pretty great.
You know, I enjoy seeing the work. Every time I see it, I'm always just thrilled to be able to say, wow, I can like actually go up to it and touch it, because that you have so many things online, but to see them in the flesh, they are very vivid and they are very clear and they are very, they're beautiful. I like your style. And it's a very, very distinctive style. I think that you've probably been told that more than a million times. So, you know, it is, there is no question that when you come upon a Talia Lempert painting, you'll go, oh, that's Talia's, you know, without a doubt. Well, tell people again where they can get a copy of the Classic Bicycle Coloring Book and find out more about all your work, actually.
Ah, well, pretty much everything is on my website, bicyclepaintings.com, and I post every day what I'm working on in the studio section, and I have an events page which says where I'll be and what's coming up. And then the coloring book is available through Microcosm at microcosmpublishing.com and in a lot of bookstores everywhere.
I will see you in Philly. And we can catch up there. Yes. And thank you so much for talking with me today. I'm hoping the people are thinking, you know what? This sounds like a good place to shop for the holidays. We're doing it early, you know, and unlike the people who wait until like the 24th of December and say, oh, you know what? Maybe I should. Oh, well, it's too late. So thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right. We'll see you in October.
Looking forward to it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Talia Lempert joined me from her studio in New York. For more information on all of Talia's work, you can log on to bicyclepaintings.com. So let's take another short break, and then we'll be back to speak with Bruce Hagen from Bike Law, Georgia. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
And Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. So when longtime cyclist Albert Ab Rozelle was hit and killed riding last week, my next guest, Bruce Hagen, immediately pulled the police report. What he discovered amounts to yet another case of believing the only living witness instead of conducting a thorough investigation. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So you are in Decatur, Georgia. You just rode to work, I understand?
That's correct. If I'm still out of breath, I apologize.
No,
yes,
you sound great.
Got into work.
You sound great. So I want to...
It's a nice, muggy summer day in Atlanta.
Actually, it's nice and cool here in Cleveland this morning. Unusual. It'll get muggy a little later. I want to review an article that you put up on your blog at georgiabikelaw.com. And that is on July 11th, a 75-year-old man named Ab, I guess it was Rozelle?
Yeah, Rozelle.
Rozelle.
Albert and Ab is how everybody referred to him. Correct.
He was hit and killed by a 30-year-old driving a pickup truck. And the police seemed to conclude that Ab, okay, this is pretty like mind-boggling, swerved into the driver's lane, or into the truck driver's lane, swerved back out of the lane, swerved back and hit the back end of the truck. Now, how bizarre is that, A, and B, what have you found out?
Right. So I heard about this, and I thought that this is just not matching up with what we know to be the reality of how people ride bikes, and particularly how folks who are still riding in their 70s tend to ride bikes. I know we can't always generalize, but in my experience, somebody who's riding into their 70s is somebody who is cautious, who knows how to ride, who knows the rules of the road, who knows how to protect themselves, and is aware of their situation. And to read a report that this person was riding in the lane of oncoming traffic, swerved into that lane, then swerved back into their own lane, and the crash occurred in the cyclist's own lane, it just didn't make sense that the conclusion of the officer would be there's no potential fault on the part of the driver of this motor vehicle. I looked at the road itself. It's not some snaky, windy road that you're making hairpin turns. It's a gradual curve. We ride on these things all the time, and you notice it, but it's not anything that would cause you to have to come out of your lane. It's a two-lane road, and it's pretty rural out there. So who's the only witness there that was around to speak to the police officers? Well, the person who's driving the truck. I pulled a copy of the police report. It's a fairly new model vehicle, which means that it should have an electronic data recorder that would show, if it had been examined, would show speed, would show braking, would show important data that an accident reconstructionist could use to try to figure out exactly what happened. So it just doesn't match up, and it just doesn't seem right. And unfortunately, it fits a narrative that we see all too often at Bike Law in terms of police investigations not being thorough enough when it comes to investigating bicyclist accidents. And what I find is that officers show up with a predetermined bias that the bicyclist must somehow be at fault, so they're going to look for and focus on facts that support a theory of the bicycle being at fault to the exclusion of all other evidence. So this is what gets me particularly aggravated. That's what motivated me to write that blog post, which has been shared probably about 100 times by now. So it's definitely got some traction.
Well, it's been shared actually more than that because it's on my Facebook page, The Outspoken
okay.
Cyclist. But the truth is that this is not the first time we've heard this kind of story. And I know my listeners get tired of my reporting on the fact that cyclists are hit, killed, and then maybe the driver gets a slap on the hand. And it's recently, I don't know if you know Steve Magus, he's the Ohio, he's not part of the Bike Law network, but he had a case up here where a driver was blinded by the sun and ran into five cyclists, killing two of them on a training ride, an evening ride, just a club ride. And the jury, a jury trial, actually acquitted the guy, saying, well, the sun was in his eyes. That is such a shoddy excuse.
It's a shoddy excuse, and it's an excuse we would never accept if it involved a car versus car crash. I've seen one particular case. This is really the first one that exposed me to the problem that we have with police not doing a good enough job in investigation sometimes. This was a case where a cyclist was hit and killed just having gone into an intersection through a stop sign. And there was a witness who had been trailing the guy on the bicycle by maybe 100 yards or so, who said, oh, the guy ran through the stop sign. We did an accident reconstruction on this that showed that he couldn't have run the stop sign because the only way that this collision could have occurred was with the person on the bicycle going between 2 and 4 miles per hour. Interestingly, the same person who claimed that the guy on the bike ran the stop sign also said that, and I clearly saw the car come from his right and hit him, moving from right to left. Well, the car was going from left to right, and there was no dispute that the car went from left to right. That's the only direction the car could have come from, was left to right. But this same eyewitness who was so wrong about a critical fact, the officer was willing to take what she said about another critical fact at face value, and that was the end of his investigation. There was nothing more done to determine who was at fault, where this vehicle had come from, how fast he was going, nothing. And so that began a commitment on my part to try to do what I can to make sure that there is balance in the way that police come and investigate these bicycle crashes. I'm not just here to be critical of police officers, because I understand that they have a very difficult job, and I don't just complain about it. I have gone and done training for entire police departments here in the metropolitan Atlanta area, where we speak to their officers and we give them a certification course where they learn the law about bike riding and also very practical information about how we ride, so that, when they come to a situation, say, well, person was riding in the middle of the lane and they should have been all the way over onto the curb, you know, right side of the curb, to explain to them why situations exist where we're safer in the center of the lane, why we take the lane, why it's even safer for the car behind us if we take the lane. So we want them to understand rider behavior, but also make sure that they understand the law as it relates to cycling. It's shocking to me every time I do one of these courses how there are too many officers who just are ignorant as to the specific laws in their jurisdiction about or that apply to bicyclists.
Why is that so glossed over as opposed to let's focus on just motorists? There are other people on the road. Pedestrians are crossing the road, cyclists. I'm not understanding why the police just gloss over this important, I mean, obviously the most vulnerable people.
Yeah, and it's hard to answer that. I mean, obviously, we are part of their constituency. They're here to serve and protect us as much as they're here to serve and protect anybody. I just think it's a matter of folks speaking up and making police aware that, look, we are the same human beings when we're on a bike as we are when we're in a car, and we deserve the same respect that anybody deserves. And you know, I also believe it's incumbent upon us when we ride our bikes to be somewhat of ambassadors for the entire bike community. I ask the officers when we talk and when I start one of these sessions, you know, what are your perceptions about people who ride bikes? And you know, you hear from them the complaints that people have about the worst of us. Never stop for stop signs. Ride five across the road. Take up the entire lane. So you know, we'll talk about those one at a time. Well, when you're on a bike, just recognize that you are there as a reflection on the entire bike community, whether you like it or not. So behave like that. And I think that's a first step. I also think just, you know, society-wide, when we emphasize that we matter and there's enough of us to have a voice in the public discussion, that police departments and police officers themselves will hopefully come around. But, you know, like I said, they have a tough job. All we want is for them to approach these crash scenes with a certain degree of neutrality and not be biased when they show up, and try to be objective in the way that they investigate it, because literally lives are in the balance. And, you know, this widow of Abrazel is going to have to now overcome what's in this report if she's ever to try to obtain any kind of justice for what happened to her husband.
Yeah, exactly. Besides having to mourn him and bury him at this point.
Right, right.
So I want to remind our listeners very quickly, we're speaking with Bruce Hagan. He is with Bike Law in Georgia. There is a network of bicycle attorneys all over the country under the Bike Law banner. Their job is to protect us and to help us get through these horrible situations and even less horrible situations, because the truth is sometimes a cyclist is at fault. But the vast majority of the time in a situation like this, somehow the driver walks away, and it just is beyond infuriating. It's sickening in its own way.
I can't tell you the number of police reports I've looked at where the driver of the motor vehicle will say the person on the bike came out of nowhere, and yet police officers will not find that driver to be at fault. So how is it that somebody comes out of nowhere? Well, if you're distracted, if you're not paying attention, if your brain is shut off to the existence of cyclists, of course it appears like we come out of nowhere. But we know that that's not the case. We know we exist. We're
right
on the road.
We had to come from somewhere.
We had to come from somewhere. And yet, you know, again, the too many times I see instances of police officers just accepting that bogus explanation at face value, and that's the end of the investigation, and no tickets are issued. It makes it very hard for us to obtain justice in a civil case when the officer approaches it like that. But fortunately, you know, one thing we are at Bike Law, beyond just advocates for safe cycling, is, you know, we're here to try to help pursue these things for folks and to pursue their rights, and to stand by them for whatever it takes. I mean, the lawyer who tried that case in Ohio and lost, I admire his effort, because we just don't accept no for an answer, and we're willing to go and fight a good fight. If we can't convince 12 people from the community, well, so be it. I mean, it's a step in the right direction, though, at least that he's trying. Then one thing that we find has been very helpful when it comes to dealing with law enforcement, with helping law enforcement, and also helping get justice in the civil context, is more and more people are riding with front and rear facing cameras on their bikes. If Abrazel had that on his bike, presumably it would answer the questions that everybody now has about what really happened here. And so, yeah, the cameras are expensive, but, you know, think about it in the overall context of things, it's an investment that's worthwhile if you can afford it. And again, as you said earlier, it doesn't mean that we're always in the right when a crash happens. But the evidence that's preserved on a video camera, front and rear facing, really makes a difference to us in a huge way. We're seeing it more and more in the cases that we handle.
So one of the things that, you know, we ride with is a GPS system. And of course, the GPS system tracks a turn by turn by turn. It knows where you are in real time. And I remember years ago a case in Colorado where a young man was coming out of a street. And this woman said, no, he wasn't coming out of that street, that he was somewhere else. The police believed her. The police report got filed. They wouldn't go back and do anything. He sent the GPS data to the insurance company. They immediately paid the claim, bought him a new bike, paid the medical expenses. They were not going to dispute this because they had the data in front of them.
We've got one right now where witnesses were putting our bike rider as doing between 30 and 35 miles an hour.
Oh, good for him. He should be at the tour.
Well, in a narrow space that would be wide enough for a bike lane, but kind of a narrow space there, and then he gets clipped by the car. So they're trying to blame this rider for going so fast. He pulls out his Garmin data and says, look, I'm going 17.9 miles an hour. And then an instant later, I'm going zero. You can see exactly how fast I'm going. So, yes, the GPS data you can get now can also be very helpful. It can also be damaging, as you can imagine. But more often than not, we find it to be very helpful. And it's the same thing we get from the black box data on the newer motor vehicles and trucks, because they're recording speed, they're recording maneuvers, they're recording if a vehicle or if a driver has his foot on the accelerator or not. You know, we get all that data when we can get to something fast enough. I don't know if the officer in the Abrazel case took the time to look at that. Again, I'm concerned that just he heard this story from the driver of the swerve and the swerve back and accepted that at face value, and that was the end of it. But there's typically going to be data there that accident reconstructionists would find very useful to be able to piece together from the physical evidence what really happened.
Well, and I know there's cell phones and cell towers and all of that stuff. So there's a lot of data that we wouldn't have had years ago that could help your case, this case, which isn't your case yet, but my guess is that more and more people, unfortunately, have to contact you for these kinds of cases.
Yes, and especially, you're in Ohio, so there's definitely a riding season. Atlanta, believe it or not, we have seasons down here. And so,
oh, sure.
They're a little shorter than yours, but we have a winter. This time of year, it's sad because you just know you're going to wake up in the morning and read some story or hear from somebody who has just witnessed a crash or knows somebody who was just in a crash. And it's just about every single time an avoidable thing if drivers would pay closer attention. I do feel like, we're a growing movement here and that there's more of us on the ride. And the more people who are riding, the more visible we all are as a group. I also think that it gives us a voice politically where our government is going to be forced to listen to us and to spend some money on infrastructure to protect us, because ultimately awareness and infrastructure are going to be the best things to keep us safe.
Well, I have one more thing to talk with you about, and that is the, what's it called? The annual bike ride across Georgia. When is that?
So we just finished the bike ride across Georgia.
Oh, it's done. Okay, cool.
It's done, but they do some smaller rides in the spring and fall, and they'll be like a 2 or 3 day ride. It's a great experience, and for anybody who hasn't done it, come on down to Georgia. It's run by some wonderful people who are real supporters of the bike community. And Georgia is a friendly place to ride in the sense that they don't typically take the Bragg ride through some of our highest peaks. So it's a challenging ride, but nothing that's going to wear you out too much.
Well, thank you, Bruce. So again, it's Bruce Hagan. He is with the Georgia portion of Bike Law, and you can go to bikelaw.com/state/Georgia if you are looking for an attorney to help you with any kind of crash in Georgia. And just for some great information, there's a great blog. There's information about, it's called Learn. You have a portion on your site, what to do if you're in a crash, why we don't say bicycle accident or bike accident, how to ride safely, and more. So thank you so much.
Diane, I would just add to that, there's also great information that we put out on Facebook typically and other social media, but follow Bike Law on Facebook, or if you're in Georgia, Bike Law Georgia, three words. You can email me, bruce@bikelaw.com. I'm happy to answer any questions. And I really do appreciate your time, Dan, and thank you for what you're doing, because you're doing an incredible service here for the whole bicycle community.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You have a great day, and we will talk again.
All right. Thank you.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bruce Hagan joined me from his office in Decatur, Georgia. If you are interested in reading more about Ab Rozelle's case, learning about what to do in case of a crash, or have a question for Bike Law, you can log on to bikelawgeorgia.com. So I'd like to thank all of my guests this week, Dorothy Pacheco, Talia Lempert, and Bruce Hagan. Next week, we'll talk with the founder of Little Bellas, Sabra Davison. So please remember that you can subscribe to our podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and all the other great podcast apps. If you feel the urge, like us and review us. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. So I hope you have a great week. Please remember to stay safe, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening. Ride safely, and we'll see you next week.